listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And we got a lot we're going to cover today, a lot of territory. Chattanooga, Tennessee, very few people think of Chattanooga, Tennessee as like a place that is just, you know, engaging in groundbreaking behavior. It's just absolutely extraordinary. I got to tell you about this. The Soylent Green is made out of the 1%. Really? This is an interesting one. The effect of sugar and the effect of inequality on sugar. And then, of course, there's the Super Bowl. You know, we talked yesterday about, you know, football and the Super Bowl in general. But the Super Bowl ad from Coca-Cola, where they had a series of different people singing America the Beautiful in different languages. I mean, it started out in English, and then, I think of Spanish, Arabic. I'm not sure of, frankly, all the languages. Here's a little bit of a clip from it. No? No, we don't have it. Okay. No, it's fine. All right. We don't need to play it. You can see it on YouTube. You can check it out. And it has the right-wing blogosphere went nuts racist, xenophobic, hysterical tweets. I mean, just the whole tweet thing is just amazing. Michael Patrick Leahy, writing over at Breitbart.com, he said the company used such an iconic song to push multiculturalism down our throats. It's no wonder conservatives were outraged. Multiculturalism. Coke is a multinational corporation that does more business outside the United States than inside the United States. On the one hand, I don't think that's the point they were trying to make, though. The United States is a nation of immigrants. Just ask any Native American. Then Alan West, former Congressman Alan West, he says, the languages went from English to languages I didn't recognize. We are on the road to perdition. Holy cow. Todd Stames said, Coca-Cola is the official soft drink of illegals crossing the border. So Kevin Jackson has dropped off my board now.
Am I not on?
Yeah. Hey, there you go. You're on Skype. Hey, Kevin. Kevin Jackson is with us. He's the executive director of The Black Sphere, a conservative columnist and syndicated radio host. The Black Sphere, SPHERE.net is the website. And Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Appreciate being
here with you.
Thanks for joining us. So, you know, I'm assuming that you saw these racist and xenophobic tweets. What's your response to these?
Well, there were, you can't follow all the tweets, Tom. I don't think you follow everything that's happening in the Twitter world, because you'd have to be up 24/7 and probably have a staff about 100 times larger. But let's just focus on the ones that you were talking about. I can't say I speak for the entire conservative movement on the tweets that the individual people made, like you mentioned, Patrick Michael Leahy Alan West happens to be a good friend of mine. But what I will tell you is I think there's a couple things at play here. One is the commercialization of the Super Bowl to sort of make it about a political statement versus just enjoying a football game. I think that's issue number one.
Well, wait a second. The Coke's iconic song from the last two decades, I think, was I Want to Teach the World to Sing. And they had, people, I mean, they did the whole thing in English, but they had people of all colors and all nationalities, and they did this in other countries and other languages. And it seemed to me like this was just the newest incarnation of that. That, hey, we embrace everybody. Everybody loves Coca-Cola.
Well, okay, so it's a feel-good song. I certainly remember the jingle and grew up with it. But what I'm saying is, this is an American sport, football game. It's, baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet or whatever. And right,
they sang America the Beautiful.
Yeah. Okay. So look, here's the point. I don't think most conservatives care that America is the mosaic of all the different people and the languages that Coca-Cola was trying to convey with that. I don't think most people cared about that. I think what most people care about in terms of conservatives is the idea that we can't get people to learn English. If you were to go to Mexico and you were to shoot that commercial, you'd have a bunch of people that wouldn't understand any of it except in Spanish. And there's
well, no, it's not true. Actually, I've spent a fair amount of time in Mexico, and Mexico is a fairly multilingual society. More so than the United States.
No, that is absolutely not true. The United States is far more multilingual than Mexico.
You've been to Mexico?
I had an office in Mexico for many years. The United States is far more multilingual than most of the other cultures or countries want to give it credit for. We embrace the idea of multicultural.
Then why are we upset about this? Here's my let me just lay out my concern with the response to this, Kevin. In 65, I think it was, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he told Bill Moyers, the Democratic Party is going to lose the South for a generation because of this, but it's the right thing to do. I'm going to do it. And in 72, Nixon, in the election of 68, Nixon explicitly, we now know from the tapes, explicitly said, let's get those white racists on board. They've been in the Democrats' back pocket for the last 50 years, and we can pick them up. And he did. And that was called the Southern Strategy. And then last point, and then it's all yours. Sure. Ronald Reagan, after he was anointed as the Republican nominee in 1980 at the convention, his first speech, his most iconic speech, the speech that set the tone for everything, his first speech was on states' rights and was given in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place where three civil rights workers were murdered in the 1960s. The Republican Party has been all about dog whistle politics to the racists and xenophobes ever since 1972. And this response says to me it's still total.
It's total nonsense. First of all, when you quote
The things I just told you are true.
Okay, well, why did you leave out the part of LBJ saying I'll have those blanks voting Democrat?
That's actually, you know, I have heard that from four or five different conservatives. You cannot find that tape. It does not exist. That was made up on a right-wing website about 3 years ago, and it has gone completely viral in the right-wing blogosphere and stuff. But I'll tell you,
okay,
I will personally bow down to you and say anything, literally anything you want, if you can prove to me that that happened, because it did not. It absolutely
did happen, as well as
no, it did not.
As well as LBJ making the comment that we'll give them just enough to get by, and on and on. Look,
no,
LBJ is
did,
LBJ.
Stuff,
LBJ
this
is
stuff
a,
is fiction. I'm telling
LBJ
you, it's fiction, Kevin.
LBJ is an avowed racist. And if you want to talk about, you know, here's the thing. We're getting off the subject of the idea that America
The official policy of the Democratic Party was not racist. In fact, they signed the Civil Rights Act.
Policy,
the Republicans
the official policy of the Democratic
tried
Party
to block the Civil
and
Rights
including,
Act.
And including all of their platforms, if you choose to go back and do the research, was absolutely xenophobic. It was absolutely
prior
racist.
To the 60s, yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
Not just prior to the 60s. In fact, we can get off field on who, because we're going to disagree on that. What I want to go back to is
I'm talking about the facts. I can play tapes of LBJ.
You're not talking about facts. If we want to talk about facts, let's talk about a commercial. You made a comment that America is not multilingual. The majority of the people in this country speak more than one language. We have lots of Mexicans. We have
more
lots
than
50%
of Americans are bilingual or more.
Yes, more. Most of the country. Most of
then
the
we should love this
bilingual.
Commercial, shouldn't we? Shouldn't we?
We should what?
We should love this commercial if we're polylingual.
That's the point I'm making.
Oh, okay.
We love the commercial. We love the idea behind the commercial. There's not a conservative in this country that says we don't want people to come to this country. America has
been. Hang on
just
a second, Kevin.
This is the Tom.
I'm sorry,
Hartman
this guy always
program.
Steps on me. Kevin, we're out of time. TheBlacksphere.net is the website. Kevin, I look forward to future conversations. I'm sorry that
all right,
know, hard breaks
no
and
worries.
All that. Good
no
talking
worries.
With you.
You take care.
You too. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. And Andrew, welcome.
Hey Tom, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to start out with a continuation of the conversation that I was just having with Kevin about the Super Bowl ad.
Yeah, you'll get into a little more in depth what you were just talking about, and we'll really talk about, I mean, these comments that have been popping up since the ad air. It's just, it's amazing how much bigotry is in today's Republican Party, and it really seems like the party is harboring it and growing it. It's a really scary thing to be talking about in this day and age, but it seems pretty true, so we'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And other topics?
We'll get into the Rumble after the rant with Huey Newsom, Nate Sweet, and Mark Harold, and we'll be talking about a bunch of things, including Elizabeth Warren proposing that payday lending should be done by the post office, and she would eliminate payday lenders, which is a pretty interesting idea that we will be talking about.
It'll save poor people literally billions of dollars.
Yes, it would save them a ton of money, so hopefully it's something
to gain some traction. And it could be a great revenue source for the post office.
It could, which we know is hurting very
poorly.
Yeah,
because of this
right
Republican poison pill from 2006.
Yep. We'll also be talking about Arkansas refusing to back Medicaid expansion, which seems to be the trend with Republican lawmakers across the country. And as a result, 4.5 million people don't have health care coverage because they fall into the red state donut hole that we've talked about.
Yep. I think the number is actually 5.4, but yeah.
We'll also be talking about Republicans and their ongoing fight to not raise the minimum wage across the country. That should be an interesting debate, and it also comes on the heels of Connecticut's governor saying that he wants to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 for all employees.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be interesting. And then finally, we'll get into a discussion about tar sands. And if tar sands oil is so important, why can't they refine the stuff up in Canada so we don't have to deal with the environmental consequences of it? It's the dirtiest form of liquid energy on the planet. So if this has to happen, why can't it be done up north, not in the U.S.?
It's a good plan. It's a good point, and it's a question I am constantly asking. In our best of the rest section, we're going to talk about heroin.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about heroin. We're going to follow up the daily take you did last night about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, and we'll be talking about what can be done to prevent heroin overdoses in this country. And we'll talk a little more about your take on legalizing heroin and making it so it's not such a—
Well, not legalizing it, but making it a prescription drug.
Right.
Yeah.
Giving people more access to it.
Yeah, yeah. Decriminalizing it, but making it actually a drug that can be used to treat heroin addiction,
and
as they do in Switzerland.
And studies have shown that if that were put in place, heroin overdose deaths would
stop,
by a lot,
basically, yeah. as well as HIV transmission and everything else.
Yeah.
Say what? Okay. Tighter economic regulation actually reverses obesity? Really?
Yeah, it looks like New York City's ex-mayor Michael Bloomberg might have been right about his sugary drink ban, but new research coming out from the World Health Organization shows that if more regulations are put in place, like limiting the size of fast food items or limiting how many fast food restaurants can be in one certain zone, it could go a long way to fighting obesity.
Obesity actually goes down.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Kevin is going to lose it tonight, our director,
yeah,
with his big gulps.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We got to get ready for that. Andrew Campbell, great talking to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Have a good one. We'll see you later. We'll see you tonight. And we'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Okay, conservatives horrified by the Super Bowl ad. I'm not sure how much time and effort I should put into that topic, into that story. It is pretty strange. It does bring out the worst of the bottom feeders, though. You know, it's the smarter conservatives, by and large, just ignored it. But the morons. Oh, man. And it's funny, Jim, our video guy, Jim Javinsky, he was telling me he was just sitting watching it with his wife and watching the game. And when the ad came on, he said, the right wingers are going to go crazy. And she was like, Robin was like, no, come on, Jim, you're crazy. You're exaggerating. And he's like, no, I've watched enough Fox News to know what's going on here. These people are going to go. And he was right. He was right. I promised you I would tell you about Chattanooga, Tennessee. Here in Washington, D.C., on a good day, I can get a download, and I've got, you know, a the top of the line consumer internet service, which is supposedly, I think, 50 megabytes download. Maybe they advertise it as 20. Maybe they advertise it as 100. I'm not sure, whatever it is. But I can, you know, I can get a measured, you know, when you do the little test things, I get 27 down, 5 up megabytes. And for that, I'm paying whatever I'm paying. I think it's like something like $50 a month. And, you know, here in the studio, we have the commercial stuff. And I'm pretty sure we're at 100 down. No, what are we? It's even slower than that. Yeah. Okay. And we're paying a fortune for this. We've got several of these lines because we've got all these streams going out. We've got three of these. And I thought we were pulling them off the cable. Yeah. And so in any case, it's just, you know, so just think about that. I mean, you know, high speed in the United States means 20 megabytes per second. Means you can watch Netflix, sort of. If you want to download a two-hour movie, it can take you a half hour. I remember many times Louise loves to watch movies on her iPad on airplanes. And so we travel a fair amount. And so if we're going to travel someplace, she will try to download a couple of movies to her iPad. You know, she'll go to you know, one of the site, Amazon or whatever, where they sell movies, and she'll just, you know, buy a couple of movies and download them and put them on her iPad. And she has to sit there and wait for hours. And I remember one time we were at the airport and it was only half downloaded. And she was like, oh my God, you know, she was frantic about it because the, you know, the download speed at the airports, even in the red carpet club or whatever it's called, the airline club, was still just painfully slow. And hooking it up to her phone and using the AT&T service with a hotspot, it's still brutally, you know, it's like 5 megs if you're lucky. So Chattanooga, Tennessee said, screw this. The internet is not that different from an electric utility or from water, right? It's becoming a natural monopoly. You can't really choose among a large multitude of providers. You got one pipe coming into your house and it's part of the commons. It's like the old, you know, Ben Franklin with the libraries back in Philadelphia, you know, it's like they should be available to everybody. Let's make this a public utility because it's part of having an informed and educated electorate. I mean, even if people do want to watch Netflix or watch porn or something, still there's the news there. There's, you know, you can communicate with people. You can talk to grandma. You can, you know, it's all right there. People increasingly are living their lives on the web, and we can debate, you know, the relative merits or health of that, which is a whole different discussion. But the fact of the matter is that increasingly you've got to have good, reliable, high-speed internet access. So keep in mind, I'm talking, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 megabyte download speeds are considered blazing fast in the United States. The average in Japan and South Korea is a gigabyte. 1,000 megabytes a second. You can download a two-hour movie in 35 seconds. So Chattanooga, Tennessee gets the city fathers get together and fathers and mothers and whatever, you know, the city council, they get together and they say, let's do this. And they took some money from the Obama stimulus, which is kind of cool. And they built out, it was a $111 million federal stimulus grant in 2009. And then they also had to borrow $219 million. They will make that back because they charge $70 a month. But you get 1 gigabyte download. You know, there's Chattanooga, Tennessee now has the same speed as everybody in South Korea, or everybody in Seoul, South Korea, anyway. And the New York Times, Edward Wyatt has this piece it'll be yesterday's New York Times, February 3rd. The headline, Fast Internet is Chattanooga's New Locomotive. They're calling it Gig City. And this town in the Appalachians, you know, and that has never really been known for anything other than just being, you know, the Chattanooga choo-choo, I suppose. But there are literally companies moving from San Francisco and New York, where they can't get this kind of internet speed, to Chattanooga. And it's created at least 1,000 new jobs and well-paying jobs. New internet startup companies are moving there. This is the new manufacturing for America. And it's because it's a public utility. It's being run by the people, for the people, at cost. No stockholders have to skim their money off the top by virtue of dividends. No CEO is making a $300 million a year salary. It's not at all like Comcast or Verizon or AT&T. No, instead, it's like the local water utility, and it works.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So far, three cities in America have done this, Chattanooga being the biggest and the best. Every city in America should be doing this. You should be running for city council on this ticket if you're thinking of it. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I've been looking for this quote from LBJ. I'll have those N-words voting Democratic for the next 200 years. It seems, you know, it gets brought up every time. I mean, literally, not every time, but the last three times I've had an African-American conservative on this program, they have thrown that quote at me. And I would bet virtually any amount of money that a white person gave that quote to them. And it looks like that quote originated in Ronald Kessler's book, Inside the White House, The Hidden Lives of the Modern Presidents and the Secrets of the World's Most Powerful Institution, which was published in 1995. And according to the Kirkus Review, that quote is attributed to LBJ by, quote, two governors who are not named. It is an unsourced quote. And the Kirkus Review criticism of the book is that it is full of these kinds of quotes that basically have no backup. But it has become gospel. You know, one right-wing guy writes a book and says, two governors told him that LBJ said this. We'll not name the governors. And this has become basically the gospel. And by the way, if LBJ did say that, and, you know, use of the N-word back in the 60s was not that uncommon, and LBJ did come from a very racist Southern Texas background, could he have been speaking of the Civil Rights Act instead of welfare programs? But Kessler, this is the Kirkus Review, Kessler depicts as the least liked president Jimmy Carter. Kessler depicts LBJ as a lying, uncouth tyrant who stole government property for his Texas ranch and a contender for JFK's White House sexcapades. Clinton is pictured as a poor manager and a deceitful figure who spends too much time pressing flesh. I mean, you know, it's a gossip book. It's incredible. I was surprised that there was not a Snopes entry to that. Change X, and in fact, maybe the folks in the chat room can track this down a little farther than I was able to in, you know, during 3 minutes during the break there. But Change X over in the chat room says, what internet speed did Tom say he has? Shane just ran a test, and we've got commercial, top of the line, Washington, the best. We have the best internet we can get in the building, a block and a half from the Senate office buildings, three blocks from the U.S. Capitol, two blocks from the Supreme Court, next door to the Heritage Foundation. We've got the best internet we can get in the heartbeat of the capital city of the world's most powerful nation. And what were the speeds that you just speed tested us, Shano? 50 down, 5 up on one line directly connected. in our wireless, although that might be our router because we're going to upgrade our router, was 5 MIPS down, 5 MB down, 1 MB up. So anyhow. But, let's have a conversation about this. James in Fresno, California, you wanted to talk about that Coca-Cola message, a commercial. James, you're on the air.
Tom, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Oh, you sound very sort of low.
Yeah, I know. We've got a problem with our phone system here. We've always had a problem. There's some kind of a gate or something in the Telos machine, and so I don't come to you as loud as you come to me, but it seems to be always the case. But I hear you fine.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about how I think the conservative view has really got the message wrong about the Coca-Cola message. I feel Coca-Cola was just trying to find, a sort of common link between these two symbolisms, like the symbolism of Coca-Cola and the symbolism of America, and how basically that's been sort of disseminated worldwide, and just basically,
Yeah, of America as the great melting pot, like the plaque on the Statue of Liberty. Give me your heart, your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Yeah. That's all I just wanted to say.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that this was Coca-Cola's modern reinvention of "I Want the World to Sing," you know, in perfect harmony song. I mean, they were just looking for the next step. How do we take this meme of we're all in this together, we're a multicultural society, and let's celebrate that. And of course, conservatives don't celebrate that. They are very upset about the fact that this year, I believe, was the first year that there were more babies born in the United States who were not white than who are white. And they're pretty damn freaked out about it. In fact, you know, Pat Buchanan's writing books about it. So, James, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Dave in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Dave, you wanted to give us an update on your Keystone Vigil. How did it turn out yesterday? They were all over the country.
Well, we did well, Tom. We are in the center of Nebraska. 50,000 people for the city of Grand Island is the third biggest city in the state.
Right.
And so, you know, we draw from about 30 miles around. And we got, I think, 11 RSVPs and about almost 28 people showed up.
That's great. We've got to keep at it because the president has not made a decision on the northern half of the Keystone Pipeline. And last night on the TV show, I had a woman on who's an expert on this. And it turns out that all this stuff that we read last Friday and that I was talking about on the air about, well, you know, the State Department's issued a report saying, no big deal, go ahead and do it. Turns out that was corporate spin that had been dumped into the media by the corporate PR firms in advance of the release of the document itself, which is fairly long. And, you know, people took hours to read it and take it apart over the weekend. And there are several scenarios in that document from the State Department that strongly argue that if we build this pipeline, we're going to substantially increase carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And that, you know, it's not a good thing. So good on you, Dave. And thanks. I'm glad to hear it worked out well. Michael in Clayton, North Carolina, you had some thoughts on the LBJ quote and racism in America.
Yes. The gentleman obviously has studied LBJ. LBJ is a complex character. There's a lot of negatives involved in studying him.
Sure.
But his upbringing was one of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
His father lost all the wealth of the family, and he went to a lowly teacher's college, and he actually taught school in Texas to the underprivileged and the Hispanics and blacks,
right.
And he had an affinity to them. I don't know where he gets that he was a racist in the terms of the times, but he related to these people because he felt himself one of them.
Yeah. Well, and whether he did or not, his actions are what count. And he signed the Civil Rights Act. He signed the Voting Rights Act. He initiated the Great Society, which lifted, you know, which cut the poverty rate in the United States in half, and more than cut the black poverty rate in the United States in half, which paved the way on top of the integration of the military by Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt, which paved the way, which led to the integration of the civil service in the United States and paved the way for the creation of a black middle class in America.
That's absolutely correct. And I just don't understand the idea. He started what he called a war on poverty. I don't like anything they use a war with.
But that was the thing of the day. You know, Nixon had his war on drugs. So.
He created Medicare.
Yeah.
Medicaid.
Yeah.
Things, I'm a retired individual, and these are things I depend on.
Mm-hmm.
Yet people of my generation buy into the takers,
mm-hmm.
when in fact I believe we are one of the takers,
yeah.
that our fathers created a system that allowed us to get an education at a reasonable price in the 60s.
Yep.
And
well, and the 40s and 50s. I mean, you know, my dad went to college on the GI Bill, as did so many other people.
And I was the first to go to college and graduate in my family.
Right.
And I got it. I worked my way through college.
And I'm guessing you did not end up with $60,000 in college loans.
No, it's ridiculous what's happened today.
Yeah. No, it's criminal. It's criminal. Right. They are stealing the future of our children.
Right.
And this Reaganomics idea.
That if you look at the red states, which I live in North Carolina, so I live in a red state, have you noticed the similarity of the map and the Confederacy?
Yeah, I have. It is not lost on me.
It is not. Believe me, I have friends on Facebook and people I grew up with who, this is all about racism.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is for a lot of people, and I think a lot of white people want to deny that, and I think probably most African-Americans are really well aware of it, and it's like, you know, we need to, you know, I mean, how many white presidents had somebody yell, "You lie," at them during the State of the Union address, right? Michael, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So should every city in America make a public utility out of their internet and run 1,000 megabyte downloads to every home? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Yeah, I think that's okay. Oh, we got a lot of great comments and a lot of great callers. Robin in Gardner, Maine?
Gardner, yes.
Yeah, hi, Robin. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I think I want to make a comment about discrimination. Mm-hmm. Well, the other stuff I'm talking about. I'm a disabled person. I am really disabled. I cannot work. Mm-hmm. My paycheck from the state has been frozen for 6 years, without any money, any increase in money.
Right.
And you know, and my heart sponsors believe in minimum wage going up. I do, you know, but my head is saying that if minimum wage goes up and my income stays as it is, you corporations are going to just raise the prices. You know, Walmart's going to raise prices. They're not going to bite this. They're going to raise prices.
Not significantly.
Well, I don't know, but it's going to raise prices. And with my income frozen, which is bad, wrong.
Right. Well, here's the thing. If prices go up, I mean, there's this CPI, the Consumer Price Index. If prices go up, then your Social Security benefits will go up.
No, well, I don't think so, because it's just got my Social Security. That's the other thing I want to talk about. That's what I said I want to talk about, is Medicare and Social Security.
Right.
They just don't communicate with each other. I tried to contact Medicare today to try to find out how much I paid into Medicare, which I pay in a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's very expensive, actually. And they tell me I have to talk to Social Security. Well, I talk to Social Security, and they say, you have to talk to Medicare.
I've not gone through this experience myself, but doesn't Social Security just pay Medicare? I mean, you authorize Social Security to pay Medicare directly?
Yes.
So they deduct it out of your Social Security check, basically?
I don't get a Social Security check because I get Main Street Retirement instead.
Because all of the Social Security goes to cover your Medicare?
Because I get Main State Retirement, and it's an offset. I don't get Social Security.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I do get Medicare.
Yeah.
But, okay. I don't get Medicare, Social Security. I don't get anything. And the problem with me is I'm not a senior citizen yet, and so I can't take any senior citizen cuts. You know, they get tax breaks. I don't get tax breaks.
So you're not on Medicare. You're on Medicaid.
I'm on Medicare.
Oh, on Medicare. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so Medicare covers disabled people.
It does. I'm disabled. I have multiple sclerosis.
Okay. I did not know that. Thank you for that.
No, but anyway, and because I have to pay, I paid my Medicare through Social Security,
mm-hmm.
and they can't tell me how much I paid.
Yeah.
They tell me to call Medicare. Medicare says no cost. You know how much? It would make so much sense if Medicare did their own billing.
Yeah.
And it would cost. It would be economical.
Well, they give you a statement at the end of the year, don't they?
No.
They don't.
Wow. Yeah, I have it right in front of me. They gave me, you know, they don't give me, yeah, they give me a statement that says zero.
Huh.
Zero.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, Robin, I'm sorry I can't, you know, I commiserate. And I think that, you know, the all these holes that have been drilled in Medicare by Republicans over the last 30 years in order to create opportunities for private health insurance companies to come in through the AARP and whatnot and sell products to people who are on Medicare. I think that that's a crime. I think Medicare should be fully funded. I think that CPI, the consumer, you know, the cost of living adjustments, should be done against a different CPI, one that's more relevant to people who are disabled or elderly. And I know Senator Sanders feels the same, but thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, inside the White House, Ronald Kessler, he's the source of this quote that LBJ said, you know, we're going to have the N-word folks voting for us for 200 years. Turns out he writes for Newsmax. He used to write for Newsmax. And it's unsourced, and there's no attribution, and it's from a right-wing website that promotes birtherism. Right. Okay. I think, anyhow, Edward in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Edward. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Oh, great. This was regarding the internet in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it is a good idea. However, a lot of the ISPs currently use the old infrastructure or the old copper cable wires
right.
to transfer the data. So it does pose a problem if states start or if cities and states start adopting these types of principles.
Why would it pose a problem? The city is coming in and they're saying at the expense of the city, in other words, we the taxpayers collectively are going to pay for this, and they are running fiber right to your house.
It's because of the infrastructure, the amount of bandwidth traveling through these old copper cable wires.
Oh no, the backbones are no longer copper. The backbone into Chattanooga is totally fiber. All the backbones in the United States are fiber.
But not every link to every home is fiber optic.
They are in Chattanooga.
Still copper.
No, they are in Chattanooga.
Now, if every city adopted that to where every link to every home is fiber optic, I could see it being feasible. But the amount of bandwidth right now, it exceeds in some areas.
Oh, it would exceed the capacity of the backbone. But look at Moore's Law. Yeah. First of all, what you would find is that your compression algorithms would start getting more. You know, Moore's Law is that every 2 years, speed doubles and price cuts in half, as I recall. And it's been true ever since the invention of the transistor, basically. And if cities started doing this, the demand on the backbones would grow, and the backbones would just, you know, they'd figure it out better ways to push more data through the same wires, and they'd start laying new wire or same fiber cables, and they start laying new fiber cables. I mean, this is you create demand. This is the, you know, first rule of economics. You create demand. If Chattanooga is demanding a lot from that backbone is going to come up with a way to supply that demand. They will charge for it, but they're going to come up with a way to supply that demand. And the backbones are in the hands of private corporations right now, and they're looking to make a buck. So as cities start providing 1 gig download speeds to individual homeowners for $70 a month, which is what Chattanooga is charging, And that's basically break-even cost. And you know, the highly profitable ISPs are providing you, you know, 1/100th of that or 1/25th of that at roughly that same price, which is obscene. But they've got a, you know, they're among the most profitable corporations in America. And, I mean, look at Comcast just bought NBC. I mean, you know, it's like you can buy NBC with the money you're making. So, you know, as the demand expands, as cities begin to do what Chattanooga is doing, the backbones will expand. And if they don't expand and the demand is there, that, well, they will expand because it creates an opportunity for an entrepreneur. And if an entrepreneur doesn't step in, it creates enough public demand that eventually legislatures will respond. Edward, thank you for the call. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, I had a question for you. Is there a possibility that Ms. Janet Yellen, who's head of the Federal Reserve Board right now, possibly approach the president and say, sir, we need to get employment going again? And so I'm asking that you issue an executive order that all funds held outside of the United States in offshore accounts, particularly for corporations and businesses, be deposited within the U.S. borders within 90 days. Again, her motive being to stimulate employment through business capital here at home.
I would guess that she would love to do that. The problem is, Morris, that the president doesn't have that power. That would require an act of Congress.
Okay, appreciate your show. Can I take my call?
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. The only way to do that's an enforcement provision, and you could enforce that by tax law. You could enforce that by penalty. But if you're going to enforce something, there has to be the force of law behind it. And laws are not created in the executive office. The executive orders are not laws. Executive orders are directives to people within the executive branch about how to behave in executing already existing laws. And so the president can say, you know, there's already an existing law that says we have to arrest people who are in this country illegally. But I'm telling you, arrest the older people rather than the younger people, that sort of thing. I mean, he can do that kind of thing. He can work within that narrow bandwidth, but he cannot create law. And that would require that, unfortunately. You have a great idea, Morris. You have a great idea. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Oh, the Republicans believe in huddled masses. They just want to keep them huddled.
Excellent point. You know, it's
Tom, I've got a suggestion on the guy that keeps complaining about the Democrats not taking proper positions.
Mm-hmm.
How about on the debt ceiling, if Obama puts on the table cutting subsidies to the oil companies, pharmaceuticals, and the NFL?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, he suggested the other day in his State of the Union speech cutting subsidies to the oil companies. It's going to go nowhere in Congress, though, because every single Republican and a large chunk of the Democrats are in the pockets of the oil companies because the Supreme Court has said...
It's a great negotiating point, and let the Republicans respond to it.
Yeah, this is what they're doing with the minimum wage right now. And I think it's really, really smart because the minimum wage is very popular. I think, you know, taxing the oil companies would be very popular, too. Although what will happen as soon as Congress starts seriously considering dialing back the oil subsidies, the oil industry is going to start running commercials saying these people want to raise the price of your gasoline. And that's going to be a political killer. And politicians know that. They're smart enough to know how they're going to get hit. And the problem is that the Supreme Court has said that even if it's a lie, that these companies, these giant multinational oil corporations, many of them not even based in the United States, BP and Shell are based in Great Britain and the Netherlands. You know, Saudi Aramco is based in Saudi Arabia. That these oil companies can spend money in the United States to influence public opinion, whether or not it's true, in virtually unlimited sums and fashions, because money is protected by the First Amendment, which was passed by the founders back in the day. And, of course, that's not what the Constitution says.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And the gig in Chattanooga, we've talked about this, but I think it's worth revisiting. I find it fascinating how right-wingers are promoting mythologies about Lyndon Johnson. As, you know, in essence, to promote the idea, here's the meme. Here's the idea. Welfare creates dependence. This is the principal theory that if you give people money so that they can buy food, and if you give them housing so that they don't have to be homeless, that they will want you to continue doing that. And they will do whatever is necessary for you to continue doing that. And if you say, well, in order to continue doing that, you have to have babies out of wedlock, people will have babies out of wedlock or whatever, you know, if you create the system. And this is one of those great examples of where a small truth becomes a large lie. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that if people are incentivized to have babies out of wedlock, they will. I mean, of course. That was never obviously the intention of the Great Society legislation. And to the extent that it became the outcome of the Great Society legislation by the 1980s, it was changed. I mean, it's just, you know, it doesn't work that way anymore. And hasn't worked that way for quite some time. Yet that mythology is still spread by conservatives, even African-American conservatives, and it's justified by this quote from Ronald Kessler's book, Inside the White House. Ronald Kessler, a guy who from 2006 to 2012 was the chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax. Yeah, Newsmax. The uber right-wing news website, if you want to call it news. There's a funny little note in an article for Newsmax on March 16, 2008, Kessler incorrectly reported, based on a previous Newsmax story. I'm reading from, is this the Wikipedia page? Yeah, reading from Wikipedia. Based on a previous Newsmax story by a freelance writer, the Center Senator Barack Obama attended a service at Chicago's Trinity United Church on July 22nd. This is 2007. This is when Reverend Wright blamed the world's suffering on white arrogance. Obama said, no, I wasn't there. I was in Florida. Newsmax posted a correction, but after, you know, the article says, shortly after the controversy broke, Kessler confirmed to TPM that he attempted to remove information documenting it from his Wikipedia biography. This is the danger of messing with your own Wikipedia page. It's like, yeah, not generally a good idea, especially if you're trying to put in something that's just not factual, right? But you know, Kessler wrote this book in which he basically quotes unnamed sources to governors as saying that LBJ said that, you know, I will have these N-word folks voting Democratic for 200 years. Presumably the context, and I would have to look at the book to actually give you the context. I haven't been able to find a full quote anywhere. presumably the context was welfare, but it may well have been the Civil Rights Act. If it was the Civil Rights Act, I would think that, you know, the end of Jim Crow, the end of literacy tests, the end of racial discrimination, or at least the beginning of the end, might be something that people of color would appreciate. But you know, LBJ was a tough guy, but it just to take that and say, here's our article of truth. I don't know. I just it's like this is what American politics has devolved to. That when Coca-Cola runs an ad during the Super Bowl, you know, singing "America the Beautiful" in multiple languages by people of multiple colors, the right wing in America goes hysterical. The right wing in Northern Europe, and I've been to Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Finland, and I've done my radio show from Denmark and Iceland and interviewed conservative, quote, conservative politicians in both places. And these are all countries that have historically been very, very white, and they have all allowed immigration of people of color from mostly from war-torn regions in Central and Northern Africa. The conservatives in Northern Europe will just come right out and tell you that they are racists, that they don't want people in their country who don't look like them. They're not, you know, particularly embarrassed by it or ashamed of it. They're like, you know, Denmark for the Danes, right? If you don't have your genetic heritage, what do you have? This is our country. This is our language. These have been our ancestors for 3,000 years, blah, 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 blah. At least they're upfront about it. Now, if we were to try doing that in America, really the only group in the United States who could do that, who could play the race card that way with any kind of integrity, would be Native Americans. Native Americans could legitimately say, you know, this was our country for 20,000, 22,000 years, and then these people of a different race came along and started doing nasty stuff, and we don't like them here, and we'd like them to leave. And there are some Native Americans who say that. And not without good reason. But American racists who are immigrants just like the people they are criticizing, and in many cases they are the immigrants who brought over the people they are criticizing's ancestors in chains, or their ancestors brought over their American racists. They've gotten much more sophisticated in this stuff. Ronald Reagan going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, saying, you know, let's have states' rights. Richard Nixon saying, let's have a Southern strategy. Let's reach out to those Southerners that Lyndon Johnson just abandoned. You know what that's, you know what that means. Let's have voter ID laws. let's close down the voting polling places near the historically black colleges in North Carolina. Well, all over the South. I mean, this is fairly transparent stuff. Let's go after the President of the United States with pictures of him with a bone through his nose. And then you confront them with it, and they go, I'm not a racist. I just think he was born in Kenya. And Ted Cruz, who was actually born in Canada, and one of his parents is, and his dad is actually a Cuban, not even an American. But Ted Cruz looks kind of white. We had Jerome Corsi on this program, the guy who wrote the book on birtherism, the guy who wrote the original book saying Obama was not born in America. And, you know, I said, what about Ted Cruz? And he was like, well, you know, we'll accept him as natural-born American.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So apparently natural-born American means white. Do you get the state of what's going on in America here? And we just get this glimpse every now and then. It happened at the Super Bowl. And another piece of that, I would argue, is the reaction to Richard Sherman's rant. And he's with Seattle, isn't he? The Seahawks?
Yeah.
He won. Peyton, this is what's so funny. Peyton Manning was a big Romney donor. And you didn't know that? Yeah. Well, I'm all the guys over at the TV studio are like super sports freaks, and they're, you know, do you know Peyton Manning was donated to Romney? And, you know, it's the guy who owns the Denver team is a big Republican donor and a very big conservative. And the guy who owns the Seattle team, I mean, you know, it's dueling billionaires, but the guy who owns the Seattle team apparently is a Democratic donor. I've wondered if, you know, if there's any truth to the idea that every now and then God is talking to us symbolically. She goes, uh-oh, I know where he's going. You got the Super Bowl is the 100 million people watch the Super Bowl. It is the most watched event on American television. And who plays? The representatives of the two states where pot was decriminalized. And who wins? The team who supports the president and the Democrats. And who loses? The team whose quarterback supports and owner supports Romney and the Republicans. And I just wonder, you know, is this God going, psst, hey? I don't know. Probably not. I frankly don't personally believe in that anthropomorphic a God. So. But, you know, you just never know. Let's see here. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yes, Tom. It's been so long since I talked to you. It goes back to the days of Lynn Cullen in Pittsburgh and,
oh, yeah,
and yourself. But yeah. Anyways.
WPTT.
Yeah. That's been a long time.
That's like 6 years ago.
The fellow that just talked to you about the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm.
and the new leader, Yellen.
Yes, the chairwoman.
And they referred to the offshore bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you that the president doesn't have any power in this area, that it has to go through Congress. But let me say this. I am so tired of the Democrats always playing defense and never going on the offense. And this is an area where I think they should go on the offense. Now, we can't do it in the House, but they can do it in the Senate.
Right.
And what Harry Reid needs to do is bring about a bill and bring it to the floor,
mm-hmm.
and let them vote on it, that they should bring this, that they should give authority to tax.
You know, the way the Republicans do this, Howard, is they get guys like Frank Luntz to do polling and find out what are the five issues that have the largest number of independents really PO'd, right, really upset, and or could get them upset. And then they introduce legislation about that, whether it's abortion or guns or, you know, God or whatever it may be, even though it's got nothing to do with their real agenda, which is economic. Democrats should be doing that. They should be figuring out what are the things people are really upset about. I think they've got one with the minimum wage, but I think they stumbled into it or were pushed into it. But I think you're absolutely right. They need to be strategically messaging, and money stashed overseas would be a great place to go, although it would be interesting to see how it polls. Howard, thanks for the call. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. This is a great little graphic that I'm guessing was created for Facebook or whatever. You see these graphics, and they all seem to work well over there, and they get passed around. But I saw it over at Democratic Underground, and it says first they turned President Clinton's surplus into a massive deficit, then they crashed the U.S. economy and bail out the bank with trillions of dollars with no strings attached a few months before passing the baton to President Obama. Then they have the nerve to blame President Obama for blowing a hole in the deficit, in quotes. Then they block any effort to create jobs, saying the government can't create jobs. Then they blame President Obama. Excuse me. Then they blame President Obama for not creating enough jobs. OccupyDemocrats.com is apparently where this came from. Occupying Democrats is a good idea. It's a very good idea. Super Bowl ad over at Pentagon. Super Bowl ad flushes out dumbest bottom feeders on the right. Yeah. Richard Wilkinson, I was sharing this with you yesterday, this op-ed piece. I mean, this kind of goes beyond my theory that if there is an anthropomorphic God out there, one who, you know, looks down on us and tries to whisper to us from time to time, having the two states that legalized pot be the ones who go to the Super Bowl, and having Peyton Manning, who supported Romney, and the owner of the Broncos, I believe, was a Republican supporter, lose, and the Richard Sherman's team and I don't recall the name of the owner of the Seattle Seahawks, but I have been told that he is a Democratic supporter. When is that God talking to us? I don't know. You know, again, I shouldn't be talking sports because I may be wrong on some of the details. But this is the water cooler conversations that I mean, I'm not exaggerating. This was the water, not at the water cooler, but you know, around the cubicle. This was the conversation yesterday and the day before. Well, no, yesterday was Monday. Yeah, yesterday at the TV studio. Anyhow, this New York Times piece by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, they talk about inequality. Inequality in the United States is pretty much as bad as it is anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in the developed world. We are one of the most unequal societies. Now, it was not that way in 1980 when Reagan came to power. There were lots and lots of countries that were developed countries that were far more unequal than we are. But now we are, as a consequence of 33 years of Reaganomics, massive tax cuts for rich people. You only pay payroll tax on your first $117,000 of income. So anybody who is in what would that put you in? The bottom 70%, bottom 80%, pays payroll tax on 100% of their income. Whereas if you're in the top 1/100th of 1%, you're paying a fraction of that because you after $117,000, you pay no payroll tax whatsoever. So anyhow, we've become this very, very unequal society. The rich have gotten richer. The working people and the middle class have become the working poor. And they point out that mental illness in societies with big income differences like we have is 3 times more common than in more equal societies. For example, Japan and Germany are far more equal, less unequal than America. And they point out that an American is 3 times more likely to know people with depression or anxiety problems than is a German or a Japanese. You are 3 times more likely. That's 300% to have or know somebody who has depression or anxiety than somebody who lives in Germany or Japan, simply because they are less unequal societies, more equal societies. Similarly, when you look at the 50 American states, they point out, state by state, we have states where inequality is really, really high. And we have, you know, like Louisiana, and we have states where inequality, or Arkansas is probably the top of the pile with the Walton family. And we have states where inequality is quite low, Massachusetts, Vermont. You look at these states. Depression was more common in states with greater income inequality. Schizophrenia was 3 times more common. 3 times? Now, I've seen theories that schizophrenia is a consequence of mom having the flu during the first trimester of pregnancy. And there is some epidemiology to support that. But inequality producing schizophrenia? Well, it may be that mom having flu during the first trimester of pregnancy predisposes a fetus to schizophrenia. Schizophrenia usually develops in the late teens, early 20s, or through the teen years. But it may well be that what's going on is that the stresses on a person provoked by inequality cause that to come out. In other words, you could be genetically predisposed or biologically predisposed as a consequence of mom, you know, getting the flu or drinking or whatever, to something and not actually have that something happen. Sherry L. Johnson, they point out, who is at the University of California, a psychologist, published a study just, you know, a year and a half ago, saying that this wide range of mental disorders are the result of what's called a dominance behavioral system. This is part of our evolution. It's necessary for us as a survival mechanism to recognize social rank. In other words, who might be more powerful than me? Who might represent a threat to me? Who might I be more powerful to? Who might I be able to represent a threat to, or at least have a defense against, an easy defense? And so we've got an entire part of our brain. She identified a part of the brain that processes social rank. And that people who are high up in income and society are more narcissistic, and they strive for status and dominance. And people who are low down, the farther down a person is on the economy, you know, the people who are just like, you know, homeless and in that, you know, and just desperately poor, have the highest levels of anxiety and depression. These are the appropriate, these are the body's responses, the brain's responses to being subordinate to everything, to everybody. Depression. And it's really a fascinating study.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the net that I carry away from this is that it's time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts, because the Reagan tax cuts established and you know, our inequality. Good, the bad, and the very, very capper-noitedly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good! The National Congress of American Indians. The organization has released an absolutely amazing ad calling on the Washington Redskins NFL team to change its name. The ad is so effective that you really need to see and hear it in its entirety. Check it out.
Proud. Forgotten. Indian. Navajo. Blackfoot. Inuit and Sioux. Survivor. Spiritualist. Patriot. Sitting Bull. Hiawatha. And Jim Thorpe. Mother, father, son, daughter, chief. Apache, Pueblo, Choctaw, Chippewa, and Crow. Underserved, struggling, resilient. Squanto, Red Cloud, Tecumseh, and Crazy Horse. Rancher, teacher, doctor, soldier. Seminole, Seneca, Mohawk, and Creek. Mills, Will Rogers, Geronimo. Unyielding, strong, indomitable. Native Americans call themselves many things. The one thing they don't.
At this point, they show us a picture of the Washington Redskins logo on a football helmet sitting on the ground. Amazing stuff. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said before the Super Bowl that the name Redskin honors American Indians. Maybe you should talk to some Native Americans before he speaks. There's absolutely no reason for a professional sports team to use a racial slur as its name or its mascot. Good on the National Congress of Native Americans for hammering that point home. The bad. The National Republican Congressional Committee. The organization is under fire today over reports that it set up fake campaign websites to trick Democrats into donating to Republican candidates. The websites, which have been set up for Democratic congressional candidates like Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona, look like regular campaign sites until you read the fine print. Right below the headline that looks like one you'd find on a candidate-sponsored website, the site asks you to make a contribution today to help defeat Ann Kirkpatrick and candidates like her. No proof yet that the NRCC's fake websites have had a big impact on the 2014 midterm elections, but they almost certainly violate federal campaign election law. Let's just hope that old saying about cheaters never prospering holds true for Republicans this November. And the very, very ugly Republican Missouri state senators. Even though Governor Jay Nixon vetoed a similar bill last spring, lawmakers in the upper house of the bellwether state legislature are moving forward with a bill to nullify federal gun law. If passed, the bill would make it illegal. I repeat, illegal for the federal government to enforce federal gun laws within the state of Missouri. If anyone tried to enforce a federal gun law, they could face arrest and possible jail time. That's right. Missouri Republicans are so obsessed with gun rights that they're willing to start a constitutional crisis over them. That is just very, very ugly. And pretty mind-boggling, frankly. Bob in Reading, Mass. Hey, Bob. Thanks for listening. What's up?
So, Tom, earlier in the show you had a guest on. I think his name was Kevin Jackson.
Yes.
You were discussing the commercial with the multi-language Coke commercial, and he made the assertion as if it was a fact that 50% of Americans speak a foreign language, a second language.
Right.
And I work for a global company. It's headquartered in Germany. Mm-hmm. I'm on conference calls all the time, and that just didn't smell right to me. So I, at great personal effort, I spent about 30 seconds in Google finding out the answer to this. And as it turns out, the first hit that I got was an article on Forbes website called America's Foreign Language Deficit. And it states that Americans, 18% of Americans speak a second language, 53% of Europeans do.
Right.
And that kind of
in Holland, you have to speak four languages just to graduate high school.
Yeah, I'm on calls all the time with people from Germany, and you spent a lot of time in Germany.
Oh, we lived in Germany. Our oldest daughter went to high school. All three of our kids went to public school in Germany. And in the German high school, our oldest daughter had to pick two foreign languages to learn in addition to German. And she was learning German. She had no German background. And so she tried to pick English as one of her foreign languages, and that lasted for one semester. And her German school teacher, who was teaching the English class, had never been outside Germany, and he was trying to suggest that the word garage is actually pronounced garage, and that was one of many, you know, like this. And so she was constantly correcting him on his English to the point that he got so upset that he said, you've got to pick another language than English as your second language. Because she was, you know, studying German as being in the school. She'd taken French and English as her two other languages. So she ended up with something else. And I'm not sure. It might have been Russian because she ended up spending a year in the Ukraine studying Russian and graduated with a degree in that. But anyhow, back to you.
One of my colleagues in Germany shared with me that they have a word for people who speak only one language. Do you know that word?
Idiot?
No, American.
Oh, American. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. So it's 19% of Americans speak a second language? 18%. And is that fluently? Because I speak German, but it is not. I don't speak it fluently.
Yeah, it doesn't say that. It just says only 18% of Americans report speaking a second language.
Yeah, okay.
And so, I mean, the article's 2 years old. It's from 2012, year and a half old.
Yeah.
So maybe your friend is right. There was a boom in education in the last year and a half, and
nah,
jumped that from 18 to 50%.
Yeah, somehow I doubt it. Somehow I doubt it.
You think? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And let me just add, one of the things that I think is a great tragedy is, and this is, you know, there's this long quote of Teddy Roosevelt back in the day saying, you know, if you come to America, you should learn to speak English. And that was the kind of prevailing wisdom in 1900 when Teddy Roosevelt was elected vice president after McKinley was shot in 1901, became president for the next 7 years. It was prevailing wisdom. And my grandfather, now my mother's family goes back to the late 1600s, but my grandfather, my father's father, my paternal grandfather, he came to the United States from Norway in like 1916 or 1917. And just in time to join the army and fight in World War II and get wounded. And he and my grandmother, I remember, you know, sitting with them, and they would speak in Norwegian, but they wouldn't speak much. They would go off and talk in Norwegian in private. But they refused to allow my father to learn Norwegian or his two sisters. It was like, no, you are going to be an American. You are going to speak English. And a lot of immigrants now are adopting this idea that multiple languages are a good thing. And we're going to teach our child not only English and make sure that they speak English as if they were a native born English speaker, but we're also going to teach them the language of the country that we came from, whether it's Serbia or Mexico or whatever. And so you've got I think right now it is, and I think this is a wonderful thing, it is becoming politically acceptable to be polylingual or multilingual or even bilingual. And there's really good brain science on this, that when people develop a second language before the age of 7, it actually strengthens the left parietal region of the brain. It's called Wernicke's, no, Broca's. It's called Broca's region. And it's where we process language. And it also strengthens Wernicke's region on the right parietal side, which is where we process music. And that it's a good thing. It's just a good thing. So, anyhow. Jonah in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. We got a minute to the break, Jonah. What's up?
Thank you for saying Jonah again. I didn't hear it the first time. I just heard static.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was wondering, because I've been thinking a lot about the need for social connections,
mm-hmm.
for the disabled. One concern I have with the internet is if it is too commercially driven, if they, like John Stewart alluded to, if they're honest with us and say, hey, we'll get more accurate ads, like mm-hmm. that makes no difference to me at all.
Right.
If it's a social network I was spending my time on, or I was curious about something and wanted to go to what I was interested in without sharing or finding conclusions why.
Right.
Because
right.
some of the things that are found are insulting. Or if I did check out something that maybe it's not great to see all the time.
Right. You don't want that ad following you around, the fact that you visited the Victoria's Secret site or something. I got it. And this is one of the problems. This is not a net neutrality issue, and this is not a make a local ISP issue. This is an issue about the big companies just taking our data.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is privacy where we don't have protection of the Fourth Amendment, and therefore we need legislation that says that companies have to opt in to be tracked rather than opt out. Welcome back. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, you wanted to talk about Coca-Cola?
Yeah, but first I wanted to give a shout-out to us fellow monolingual Americans. It's not all their fault. Like in my case, I started out with Italian and English growing up, but after my grandparents died, stopped using it, and over time you forget.
Yeah. So well, this is like, not, you know, it wasn't my dad's
like
fault.
I think it is.
Yeah, it wasn't my dad's fault that he didn't teach me English Norwegian, because he never learned it. But that was just the zeitgeist of the time back in the 19-aughts and the 19-teens. But this is the 21st century. We live in a very, very small world, particularly as a consequence of the internet and air travel. I mean, they didn't even have jet airplanes in 1917 when my grandfather came over here.
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of stuff in 1917.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway.
Here's a big difference, a glaring difference between when you talk to a liberal versus a social conservative or a Republican.
Hmm.
The reaction to a Coca-Cola ad where there's, you know, a multilingual appeal.
And a multiracial appeal.
Would object to Coca-Cola because of the death squad south of the border when people are trying to organize truck drivers that drive for Coca-Cola. We criticize Coca-Cola for that. We don't criticize them for, a peaceful, kumbaya, multilingual approach, because we're supposed to be a pluralistic society. Republicans, on the other hand, they don't talk about the evils that Koch does south of the border. They talk about stupid stuff like multiculturalism.
Yeah, and how Koch, in some parts of the world where there are water problems, is sucking up all the water and draining the aquifers. Local farmers are being wiped. And it's not just Koch. This is the soft drink industry, you know, and the bottled water industry.
That on the African continent, and no one hardly ever talks about that. They get away with so much.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you. I've read the horror stories. You know, who's Vandana Shiva is one of the most outspoken writers and speakers on this kind of topic, and I would refer, you know, anybody to her work in this area.
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen. Okay. Auf Wiedersehen, actually, Johnny, would be, I'll hear you later. Although you're watching Free Speech TV, yeah, so Auf Wiedersehen. You'll see me later. Okay, cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica.
Hey, I wanted to say a big shout out to Chattanooga for what they did with the internet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did that here.
In Raleigh, North Carolina?
One of our cities had done that same thing, mm-hmm, and had a city-run high-speed internet. And then we hired Republicans to run our state, and guess what happened?
You lost it.
They passed a law. They passed a law saying that it was illegal for cities to do that.
Yeah. Well, Kansas is trying to do that right now. They're trying to pass a law.
Oh, yeah. That is disgusting. Yeah. But anyway, I also, if you will give me a chance, I want to give my fellow North Carolinians a shout out, mm-hmm, and let them know that there is going to be a rally in Raleigh,
mm-hmm,
this Saturday.
Great.
At about 10 o'clock in the morning. And it's going to be around the McDonald's in downtown. It'll start there. And if they can park, because it's Saturday, they can park in any government parking lot.
Okay, great. Great. Park in any government parking lot, Raleigh, North Carolina, downtown at the McDonald's, 10 o'clock Saturday morning, right?
Yes.
Okay, and this is on the topic of?
It's voter rights.
Voter rights. Perfect. Monica, thanks so much. Thanks for the call. Lafayette, Louisiana, and Bristol, Virginia are the other two cities that have done what Chattanooga, Tennessee is doing. This is interesting. Bristol, Virginia, a state, you know, a lot of Republicans. Lafayette, Louisiana? Really? That's remarkable. So, but it's really, this is working out very, very well. Thank you very much for Chattanooga, Tennessee. So, Bud in Yellville, Arkansas. Bud, it says you want to disagree with me about LBJ. What are you disagreeing with me about?
Well, we've been through this before. First of all, thank you for taking my call. Basically, I consider myself an independent, have been for quite a while. But I really think if you look at the history, you take Vietnam, you can't call him a humanitarian. You go into the fact that even in his state he controlled the media totally. Then you have the Billy Solis. It was the silos. He wasn't a great man, and I think he's being portrayed. And if you want to talk to,
I agree.
In Arkansas, I'm in Arkansas. For me to talk to the people I talk to, it's a give and take. You can't call black or white. I have to agree with some of the things they say.
Yeah.
I really got to be a little harsher on the people that didn't do exactly what they were supposed to do. That's just my bottom line.
I don't disagree. I'm not in the bag for LBJ. I got arrested protesting LBJ's policies in Vietnam. I mean, I think that the Vietnam War so tarnished LBJ's legacy. I think he would have gone down in history as one of our greatest presidents between civil rights and the Great Society had it not been for the Vietnam War. And yeah, the scandal with Billy Saul Estes and his ability to prevent that from really taking down his presidency was pretty Senate career, I think, is when it first broke, wasn't it? It was pretty astounding. And I read, you know, Texan Looks at Lyndon, you know, which is that book that came out before he was president that just basically accused him of murder in his first race. He had a very and which I'm skeptical of, but he had a very checkered past. I mean, and this was a guy who knew how to use power, and he would slap people around and threaten people, and he was foul mouthed, and he would sit on the toilet while he was talking to reporters, and you know, basically as a way of intimidating people. And I mean, it was just he was not somebody that I would want to have as my best friend. But the fact of the matter is that signing the Voting Rights Act, signing the Civil Rights Act, and not just signing them, he had the knowledge of how the Senate worked, and he had accumulated enough power in Congress that he could make these things happen. And then pushing through the Great Society, which is a great amplification of the New Deal, after the New Deal had been partially repudiated by the election of two Republican presidents since the Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, Eisenhower and Nixon, and one Republican president, I guess, to LBJ. It would have just been Eisenhower, but nonetheless, and Congress had been taken for 2 years during that period of time. So, you know, the New Deal was still arguably quite controversial, but LBJ did it. He did it. And I have to respect that. I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect politician, Bud. Do you think there is?
No, I appreciate everything you do. And 99% of everything you do, I totally agree with. So.
Okay. Well, I don't want to make LBJ a saint. I don't think Obama's a saint. I don't think any of them are saints. I mean, there's a couple of people in Congress right now who I have incredible respect for. Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, Keith Ellison, Jan Schakowsky. I mean, there's a handful of people that I know enough about their careers, and I've met them and talked with them enough that I know that they're the real deal. But they are few and far between because of gerrymandering and because of Citizens United. It's like Bernie's able to be the senator from Vermont because he's been in politics since he was 20 something years old. You know, or 30s, I don't know when he started, but, Mayor Burlington, way back in the day, he was the longest serving independent in the House of Representatives, and he's probably shaken hands with every person in that state at least three times. I lived there for 10 years, and I met him at least three times, just, stumbling into town hall events that he was running, that he had going on. He could do retail politics. You can do retail politics in a state of 600,000 people. I don't think that he would have been able to survive in New York or California, where big money, where you can't do retail politics, you've got to do television politics, and big money will take you down. And that's, all the more the tragedy of American politics. And that's why Dianne Feinstein and her, Barbara Boxer, although Barbara Boxer's damn good, but Chuck Schumer and whoever the other Republican from, or the other senator from New York State is that who it is? Oh, yeah, Kristen Gillibrand. That's why they're not, in my mind, they're not perfect. I mean, they have to respond at a certain level to money because that's what it takes in those states to get elected. And I'm just amazed that they're able to walk the delicate lines that they do. But there are no perfect politicians out there. And we need to be working. We, the people, need to be working to get the damn money out of politics, which means saying no to the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that they have discovered that in the First Amendment, money is protected, and in the 14th Amendment, corporations are protected. This is insane. Bud, thanks for the call. Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Alex, you got a minute to the break. You want to talk about the Coke commercial?
Yeah, what these conservative pundits don't realize or don't get is that culture is dynamic. It's not static.
Oh, they get it. They don't like it.
Well, the red state guy who's watching Glenn Beck and calling people like me, Philhart liberal multiculturalists, are the guys that don't get that culture is always evolving, it's always changing, and it's basically an argument about multiculturalism.
Yeah. Well, and cultural transformation. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was one of the most articulate spokespeople for this. He talked about how every 20 years a country needs to have a revolution. It needs to reinvent itself continuously. He said you wouldn't expect a man to wear the clothes that he wore as a child. You wouldn't expect a country as it grows and evolves to hold to the old ways of doing things. And that culture does change. And he spoke out very, very eloquently and very, very strongly against slavery on numerous occasions, particularly toward the end of his life. Yeah, I'm with you, Alex. You're good point. Thank you for the call. It's coming up on the top of the hour. We'll be back with Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Oh, this will be interesting. Sugar, alcohol, tobacco?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We've covered a lot of territory in the last couple of hours. Kevin Jackson, the executive director of the Black Sphere Conservative African American, came on and told us that all those people tweeting about America the Beautiful being sung on the Coke commercial in different languages, that was not racist and it was an okay thing, and that the Democrats are really the ones who are racist, and he knows because LBJ said so. We can talk about that. We have been, actually. How Inequality Hollows Out the Soul by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. I got back to that. This extraordinary story of a city that in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that has installed its own broadband, city-run, public service, not-for-profit, and they're providing 1 gigabyte download speed. That's 1,000 megabytes if you're struggling with your 20 megabytes or your 30 megabytes or your 5 megabytes if you've got DSL, or your one, you know, half a megabyte if you have dial-up. They're getting 1,000 megabytes for $70 a month. And there's also a lower speed, lower cost service. And it has caused the city to experience a boom like they never saw before. Internet businesses from all over the country are moving there. So a lot that we've covered so far today. Not to mention all the various politics of the day, but here's two interesting studies. One published in the Bulletin of the World Health Organization on February 3rd in Geneva, and done by an American researcher and by the name of Dr. Robert DeVogli of the Department of Public Health Services at the University of California, Davis. He will be on our TV show tonight, by the way, just FYI. And what they found, the authors of the study found, that while the average number of annual fast food transactions per capita increased from 26.61 to 32.76, average body mass index increased from 25.8 to 26.4. Thus, each one unit increase in the average number of annual fast food transactions per person, in other words, by one extra fast food meal per year per person, it's associated with a 0.0329% increase in body mass index. In other words, the more fast food you eat, the fatter you get. And therefore, should we be maybe saying, you know, there's some societal costs associated with that. Should we be recovering that by taxing the fast food industry or doing something like Mayor Bloomberg was talking about? And here's this other study, Nancy Helmish writing this in USA Today. Sugar not only makes you fat, it may be killing you. This is a study of 31,000 people, a multi-year study done in the United States, and they were looking at sugar content versus heart disease. And they found that people who consumed 21% of the daily calories, see, they're saying, you know, if the average Americans consume 15% of their daily calories is sugar, and that's bad. It should be 7% or less. In fact, if you want to say, you know, we should be eating like our ancestors, it should be zero. But anyhow, people who consume 21% had double the risk of death from heart disease. People who consumed between 17 and 21% had 38% higher risk of heart disease, of death from heart disease, dying from a heart attack for sugar. Now, a lot of people die from heart attacks, and it costs us a lot in lost productivity and medical expenses. So shouldn't we be taxing the sugar industry to recover the costs that we are paying to subsidize them? Is this not another great example of another industry that is internalizing the profit and socializing or externalizing the externalities, the costs? Mark Thornton, PhD, senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, MISES.org is the website, is on the line with us. Hey, Mark, welcome.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be back on the program.
Thank you for coming back on. So I guess I laid it out. I mean, here we have two different kinds of food that we know, when they are sold, increase the cost to society, to all of us. Should we not recover that cost by taxing sugar specifically and fast food generally?
Well, we've already raised the price of sugar by 400% over the world price, and that doesn't seem to have deterred us at all.
We subsidize it. We've raised the profits of the sugar manufacturers.
And the corn growers as well.
Right, who are sugar manufacturers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I perfectly agree and have known for a long time that excessive amounts of sugar is bad for you, that corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup is bad for you. It's harmful.
So we know that there's two reasons for taxes. One is to raise revenue, but perhaps a more important one, and this is why we determine what taxes we're going to have and what nature they're going to be, is to modify behavior. If we as a society are having to pay for these people showing up in the ER, and we as a society are having to pay for these people who are dying from diseases associated with being overweight, or, you know, continually having to take insulin or other, you know, things, you know, ongoing medical expenses, shouldn't we as a society say to the companies that are producing this public health disaster, you must help pay for it? What's wrong with that?
Well, it sounds good on the surface, but, you know, the government has screwed this situation up entirely. They're the ones that created the food pyramid and then pushed the American public off of the top of it. I mean, there's
okay, so let's agree that the food pyramid, actually, they no longer have a food pyramid. That's so 1950s.
And they don't have food stamps either, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, but, you know, that's not my debate. That's not my question. Yes, I don't disagree that the government has engaged in policies that help this. And the flip side of that is that the government is engaged in those policies because these industries are lobbying for them. And that has to do with the Supreme Court saying that the First Amendment covers money and the 14th Amendment covers corporations. And that's a whole separate debate. But should we not be recovering these costs through simple taxation? Why not?
I think we need to get to a basic level of this problem and change the way Americans look at the situation. I don't think it's so much that Americans have consuming more sugar. It's that we've been pushing them on this high fructose corn syrup, which is the real dilemma. And if you go back even further in time, it was the government that prohibited sodium cyclamate in the 1960s, which was a perfectly reasonable sugar substitute.
Except that it caused cancer.
Well, it caused cancer
in rats.
In rats, if you gave them 350 cans of Diet Coke every day.
Well, that's because a rat only lives 2 years.
Well, I mean, they're using this stuff in Britain, and they're using this stuff in Europe, and they have been right along, and the Europeans are all perfectly skinny. I mean, it's sad you can pick an American out in Europe just
because. It's not because they're eating sweeteners, and again, we've gotten off topic, but there is a good body of research that you can easily find that indicates that when people drink artificially sweetened, regardless of the sweetener, artificially sweetened beverages, they gain weight. And the reason why is because the body doesn't know how to tell the difference between an artificially sweetened drink and one that's not. And so it excretes the same amount of insulin in order to metabolize what it thinks is that amount of sugar. If you drink an artificially sweetened drink or eat an artificially sweetened food, it's more often drinks. The body produces that insulin, and if there's not sugar there to balance that insulin, it throws you into hunger and it causes you to overeat. So soft drinks are just as bad because you end up overeating anyway. Soft drinks, diet drinks are just as bad as regular drinks. But back to the question, why not recover these costs with taxes? Why not modify behavior with taxes? What is so hysterically bad about that?
Well, taxes are bad in general, for one thing.
Why? I mean, we built a great industrial empire with taxes on imports. They were called tariffs.
Well, that's because the federal government was limited at that time. That was their only source of taxes, and we've spiraled out of control to ever more new increases in taxes. And, you know, this is just another example of the slippery slope.
So your response to this is just a knee-jerk, I don't like taxes?
No. I mean, I've given you other reasons why the government has screwed the situation up in the first place.
Let's stipulate that the government should stop screwing the situation up. Still, there's going to be sugar and there's going to be fast food. Shouldn't we recover the costs from the manufacturers of the sugar and the fast food?
Nobody thinks that would work, the increase.
I think it would work.
Well, I mean, we've increased the price of sugar.
It worked with tobacco, by the way. In the states that increased tobacco taxes substantially, tobacco consumption actually went down.
Well, you know, I'm all for that, but that trend was in place prior.
No, I mean right now. You can look state by state. Anyhow, Mark, we're out of time. Hang on just a second, Mark.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I hate it when that guy steps on me. Mark Thornton, Ph.D., Mises.org. You can read all about it. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be right back. So, is Bloomberg right? Boy, it's difficult to have those words cross the palate, right? You know, Bloomberg was right. But this fellow, Robert DeVogli of the Department of Health Sciences at the University of California, Davis, he's not calling for taxes on fast food. He's calling for regulation. He's saying that cities, counties, whatever, that we should say that you can't have greater than a certain density of fast food outlets, and that fast foods should not exist in places like schools and hospitals. I've actually been in a hospital with a McDonald's. I'm not making this up. It was a couple of years ago, and I forget where it was, but it's burned in my brain. There was a McDonald's in a hospital. I don't think it's all that uncommon. And so should we not say what he's calling for is regulation, which I never even got to, and I'm sure, would have made Mark's brain explode. I'm not sure. I shouldn't speak for my guess. But, well, anyhow, we'll get into that. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Danke, Tom.
Bitte. Bitte schön.
I just wanted to mention, if you have not already said this, I had to walk away for a minute. The U.S. Farm Bill, which is $1.5 trillion this year, contains its normal subsidies for growing sugar.
Right, and it was just passed today.
Yes. And if we want to cut down on sugar and things like this that are not good for us, stop the subsidies and raise the price of sugar.
Yep. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I mean, you know, Mark's point that our government policies are screwed up is true. His argument that they're screwed up because it's government is wrong. They're screwed up because the corporations, because the Supreme Court has established a circumstance, a situation, by their Buckley decision saying that money is protected by the First Amendment, and their First National Bank versus Bilotti decision saying that corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment, and then Citizens United saying both on steroids. They have created a situation where these corporations can buy their very own politicians. They can write their very own legislation. The American Legislative Exchange Council does this, you know, every twice a year they get together and they put Republican state legislators and lobbyists one for one, you know, sit next to each other in a room and they write, quote, model legislation. And then they go out and submit it in all the states. And it's everything from stand your ground, shoot first laws on behalf of the NRA, to the voter ID laws on behalf of the Republican Party, to lots and lots of stuff on behalf of individual special corporate interests. Go ahead.
Well, like I said, you know, I'm like you, I eat more organic food than I do anything else, and organic foods very seldom contain any sugar at all. Usually they have honey in it, which breaks down differently in the body.
Right.
But when you have all of these sugary drinks, that, you know, you can't go anywhere here in the South without being offered sugared tea.
Right.
And you can't, You know, and you don't know if it contains sugar or if it contains high fructose corn syrup.
And it's almost always the latter because it's less expensive because we subsidize corn. I'm with you. Norma, thanks for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Occupying the media. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland, listening on Progressive Voices. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, thank you. I always enjoy listening to you because you always confirm my knowledge about how power hungry the left is. The
confirmation bias.
Yeah, it's great. The taxing and regulating sugar is after another classic example of liberal economists who don't understand economics.
Let me ask you a simple question then. What is your answer to an industry or a business whose business model is to cause harm and profit from that and let somebody else pay for the remediation of that harm? What is what's the appropriate way to respond to that?
Internalize, have the people that are putting the cost, like you're saying that if people eat a lot of sugar, they get fat, and that puts cost on society.
Not just sugar, fast food also.
Fast food, right. So put the cost on the people that are eating the sugar and the fast food.
So you want to run around and tax people based on their weight?
Why not? If I don't. But
the way you tax them based on what the food that they're eating is by taxing the food.
Would you tax rap music?
If you could demonstrate that it was producing a social ill, yeah.
Right. Okay, so anything that any academic study can prove that causes what somebody thinks is a social ill, you think the government has the right...
Well, let me rephrase that. No, Joe, I spoke too soon. Let me rephrase that. Anything that you can demonstrate is producing a social cost... Not necessarily an ill. There may be things that we think are immoral or something, but a social cost.
So if rap music was shown to increase certain types of crime, which is a social cost,
right?
You would then support taxing rap music or violent movies or
to help pay for the law enforcement. Yes.
Yeah.
If you could demonstrate that. Now, to the best of my knowledge, that has not been demonstrated.
So if they could, I mean, we predicted this 20 years ago. There were some crazy professors at Yale. I was back in the Ivy League when I was an economist at the time, too. They were talking about how they need to tax the fat content of food and tax sugar content and everything else.
Oh, yeah. It's been around for a long time.
The underlying assumption is the government should be able to control absolutely every aspect of your life, and all that matters is if you can somehow show
your premise is wrong. When you predicate a statement with a false predicate, everything that follows becomes irrelevant. You said the government should be able to control every aspect of your life. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that when an industry or a company has a business model that causes a cost to society, that society has not just the right, but the obligation to recover that cost from its source.
Every study I've seen shows that if people don't get enough sleep at night, they are less healthy, and that puts a cost on society. Should we be able to, the government be able to tax people if they don't get enough sleep at night?
If there was an industry or a business,
why is it
let me finish my sentence. If there was an industry or a business whose business model was to do something that caused people not to get a good night's sleep, and you could demonstrate that there was a cost associated with that, yeah, I would say, you know, what's the cost associated with that, and how do you tax that? Sure.
Why do you focus on a business? If a person, if I decide to watch TV and, if I decide to watch all the late night TVs and you know, lose sleep, so either you should tax me because I'm not sleeping.
No,
well,
you're taxing yourself.
Or you should tax.
No, you're already you're taxing yourself. You're being less productive. If you're less productive as a consequence of your TV watching behavior, that's your problem.
That's not an externality. You don't understand what an externality is. If all the cost is on me, there's no externality. And you're saying
that's my point. Individuals don't produce externalities. Businesses do.
They do too.
Well, it's not an externality because it's you are producing your own cost. You're not externalizing it. You are paying for it yourself. If you're less productive, your income's going to go down. If you're not sleeping enough, you're going to die earlier.
No, if I don't sleep, I become sick, and if the
right, and you are suffering the direct results of it. In other words, you are experiencing the tax.
If I decide to eat fast food, I am suffering the direct effect of.
That's correct. You are paying your own tax.
But if the fast food is
being promoted to you by an industry that knows that it is going to cause you and many, many other people to become less productive and to cost society something, shouldn't that industry pay some of that cost? See, you're saying that the individual is always responsible. I don't believe that. If the individual was always responsible, advertising would not exist.
So you're saying that if we could show that some late-night TV, if they encourage people to stay up late, and they know people staying up late is bad for them.
Well, not necessarily. Some people sleep in late in the morning.
Oh, no. Well, not fat, fatty food doesn't affect everybody. I know people that eat fat food all the time. They have great cholesterol level. They live to be 100 years old. It's fine. I mean, it's just this idea that if some academics can prove that there's some arguable cost associated with some activity.
They looked at 31,000 people, and they found that if you 21% of your calories came from sugar, you had twice the risk of heart disease. The sugar industry is externalizing. They're doubling the death from heart disease. They're externalizing the death of people, and they're not paying for that. Why is Hollywood, that okay with you?
Hollywood is then externalizing their violence, crime, and everything like that.
If you can prove that, Joe, I mean, I know the theory. I get the theory. But I've not seen the proof of it. There are countries where violent movies are around, you know, in profound levels, and they don't have levels of violence. Violence seems to be more associated with inequality than it does with violent movies. And there, again, I refer you to Wilkinson and Pickett's research over at equalitytrust.org.uk. And I think you're trying to change the subject. Joe, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's very simple. What's the business model? If the business model is we keep the profits and society gets screwed, the society gets screwed part should come out of the profits. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. The health care law may result in 2 million fewer full-time workers is the headline at the top of the New York Times website right now. And conservatives all over the country's heads are exploding. They are, I guarantee you, right now on right-wing talk radio, they're going, see, we told you so. Look at this. 2 million fewer full-time workers because of Obamacare. It's a terrible thing. This is great news. This is great news. What the Congressional Budget Office has pointed out is that because people can now get health insurance, when they're only working 20 or 30 hours a week, instead of having to have the full-time job, you know, the 40-hour, 50-hour, 60-hour, you know, whatever it is week, my work day runs from 9 to 9. I don't know how many hours that is. 12 times 5 is 70. Was that 70-hour a week? Something like that. 60, thank you. You're better at math than me. So that's not so bad, 60-hour a week. Well, plus I write all weekend, yeah. Anyway. I don't do it for the healthcare. I do it because I love it. I mean, if you watch the show, you listen to the show, you know I do it. I do this because I love it. But there are a not inconsiderable number of people in America. Some studies indicate as much as a third of the American workforce, I'm guessing it may even be larger than that, who hate their work and would much rather not do it, but they're doing it because they have to. Now, we used to call that, you know, indenture or slavery. I mean, slavery is a bit extreme, but, you know, undesirable. Right? The people would work at something that they hate doing simply because that's absolutely necessary to live. But it's really kind of the industrial society way. It used to be people could, you know, they'd live on the farm. They could be self-sufficient. Yeah. The average, you know, in indigenous societies, there's a book written called The Original Leisure Society back in the 70s about Aboriginal societies, that the average person in an indigenous society, hunting-gathering societies, works 2 hours a day, spend the rest of the time playing with the kids, playing with the family, doing songs, dancing, poetry, telling stories, transmitting culture. So I see this as really good news, that people are going to be able to say to dead-end, no-good, lousy jobs, I don't need this job anymore just because it has health insurance associated with it. And I'm going to take a job that where I work fewer hours, particularly for the, you know, almost half of the workforce now, there's a significant portion of the workforce that are parents who would really rather be home with their kids. Keep in mind, half of all American children come home to an empty house after school. Wouldn't it be great if one parent in those households could say, you know, instead of working from 9 to 5 or 8 to 6, I'm going to start working from 9 to 3. And yeah, I know, going part-time like that, I'm going to lose my health insurance, but hey, I can get it from Obamacare. So that's the first benefit. That's why I think this is, that's the first, there's two reasons why I think this is really great news. And I'm astounded that the New York Times in this article by Ann Lowry and Jonathan Wiseman did not point out either one of these two points. They did point out all the hysterical right wing, you know, oh my God, we told you so. Obamacare is going to cause a loss of jobs. Well, it's not going to cause a loss of jobs. It's going to cause a loss of workers. Now, what's that going to mean? It's going to mean, A, America's going to get happier. You're going to have fewer people stressed out. You're going to have fewer people beating up their kids or having, you know, getting divorces or committing suicide or being on antidepressants. Number one. And number two, what happens when 2 million people drop out of the workforce? Or the net effect of 2 million people. If, you know, 6 million people reduce their hours by 10 hours or whatever. And so the net effect is 2 million people leave the workforce. What happens when 2 million people leave the workforce is that the labor market tightens up. What happens when the labor market tightens up? Wages go up. What happens when wages go up? The middle class starts to grow, standards of living increase, and tax collections go up, which means the deficit goes down. These are all good things. And because virtually 100% of those people are paying Social Security and Medicare, they're paying payroll tax on all of their income. We're not talking the top 1% here, or the top 5% or whatever it is, you know, whoever it is making over $117,000. We're talking about people making under $117,000 a year. So all of their income is taxed for Social Security. And if you have, as a consequence of a couple million people leaving the workforce, you have the workforce tightening up and wages at the bottom going up, those wages are 100% taxed for Social Security, so the income to the Social Security system is going to go up, and so Social Security is going to be strengthened. This is great news. Somebody needs to call the New York Times and point this out to them. CBO also said, by the way, that the budget deficit is going to be falling, very last paragraphs. The good news in the article is on the fourth page when you print it out. The news in the report is not all bad for Democrats. This is the next to the last paragraph after going through three pages of basically Republican talking points. The news in the report is not all bad for Democrats. See, I thought it was all great news, but in any case, it's not all bad for Democrats. The office also sees the budget deficit falling to $514 billion in 2014. That's about 3% of GDP. From the $1.4 trillion that Obama inherited from Bush in 2009. My words, not New York Times. Many economists, the New York Times, well, Lowry and Weissman write, many economists consider deficits of that size to be sustainable in the long term. Because we do have to have, you know, I mean, it's a good thing to have a debt because then people can save. Public debt is private savings. People buy treasury bonds. The budget office sees the deficit continuing to drop in the 2015 fiscal year. See, they said $514 billion in 2014. The 2015, it's going to drop down to 4.78 or 2.6% of economic output. So that's a good thing. Although the last sentence from there, though, it anticipates that the deficit will rise again as government spending picks up absent congressional action. In other words, we need to stop spending. I'm astounded. I saw the headline, I thought, really? I read the first couple paragraphs, which explained why. Congressional Republican leaders called the findings devastating, terrible, and proof that the health care law was a job killer. The report did say that the law would reduce hours worked and full-time employment, but not because of a crippling impact on private sector job creation. With the expansion of, I'm quoting from the New York Times article here from Lowry and Weissman, with the expansion of insurance coverage, the budget office predicted more people will choose not to work and others would choose to work fewer hours. Because, you know, they don't have to work all those hours to get employer-provided health insurance. Isn't that a wonderful thing? America gets happier, fewer people take Prozac, fewer kids get beat up, fewer divorces happen. People have more time to dance and play and write novels and poetry and walk on the seashore. I think this is good. And the labor market tightens up. You pull 2 million people out of the labor market, and boom, you're going to see wages go up, you know, 1%, 2%. And as wages go up, tax collections go up, particularly Social Security taxes, because this is all happening at the bottom. This is all happening in the bottom half of the American economy. And those people, 100% of their income is subject to taxation for Social Security and Medicare. Always. You can't get away from it. Unlike Mitt Romney, who, you know, doesn't pay those taxes after his first day of work. Pays nothing after his first day of work in Social Security and Medicare. So, anyway, Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on our Pacifica affiliate there, KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was thinking about what you mentioned last hour about perhaps the divine hand of God involved in the Super Bowl, and I'm inclined to agree. I mean, here's why. I mean, I think now the winning team came from a city that is the fourth most economically upwardly mobile city in the nation. Very good. We have the highest minimum wage in the nation.
Right.
The team's winning team's colors are liberal blue and eco-friendly green. Need I go on?
Right.
God just loves us.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's God trying to tell us something. And the two states that got to compete in the Super Bowl were the two states that decriminalized pot.
That's right. Now, having said that, I have one more thing here.
Okay,
the
we get
Star Spangled Banner has got to go.
Yeah, it is a little militaristic, isn't it?
Well, the woman who sang it was very, very, I mean, what an unbelievable job. I mean, she did a great job, but is not America the Beautiful a more inspiring? Look at the lyrics, compare the lines. And
yeah.
Is not America the Beautiful a more inspiring and sung in different languages? I know some people object, but tell me if singing the Star Spangled Banner in different languages even makes sense that we would have
it. No, it doesn't. And America the Beautiful actually asks for our errors to be fixed, which is an amazing thing. Paul,
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Paul, it's always great to hear from you. Thanks for calling. And thanks for listening to KBCS. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. Shane was telling me, Joe Manchin says that this report that says that Obamacare is going to result in 2 million fewer full-time workers is Waterloo for Obamacare. Really? I think this is great news. It's like fewer people living in desperation and poverty. What is it that these... I've made my point. Dave in Granite Bay, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
I do. And thanks for listening online. What's up?
Well, I was just thinking about that stuff you were saying about violence being related to inequality with a couple callers ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about sort of the Republicans being the sort of fiscal, supposedly the fiscally responsible party in some fashion. And I started thinking about all of the costs associated with violence and crime and prisons and drugs and health and employment and environment and food and all these things. And I just keep thinking to myself, like, aren't those the costs of, related to all these kinds of studies that show this, aren't those the costs of poverty? Wouldn't it just be cheaper to just get rid of poverty and pay the taxpayer money that we put into, you know, building prisons or crime?
Yes, it would be. And that's what the Scandinavian countries have done. And that's what Lyndon Johnson was proposing. And had we continued with the Great Society in the direction that it was going, you know, tweaked it and fine tuned it and made it work. Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't it seem scientifically provable at this point? I mean,
it
is. Some kind of study. I mean, shouldn't we just put that money into just the levy? I mean, we should just pay the poor and. Who cares about the moral argument? It seems like their argument is a fed bird is a dead bird.
Yeah. And in fact, if you go back and read Agrarian Justice by Thomas Paine, you find that in 1790, here's Thomas Paine, or in the 1790s, I forget which exact year, here he is writing a brochure, basically, a short book, suggesting that everybody should be, when they're born, they should get a trust account so that when they come of maturity, when they become 17 or 21 or whatever the age of maturity was back then, that they have enough money that they have a basic guaranteed income for the rest of their lives. And among other things, I mean, he also proposed Social Security and a minimum wage and things like that. And he basically proposed the New Deal. And so it's not like it's a new idea. And it's been around for a long, long time. And as the democratic socialist countries have tried it, it's worked, and the only kind of sad thing is that a lot of those countries are now starting to listen to the neoliberals. They're starting to pull back from their social democracies, and the consequence is that they're starting to see, you know, fractures and cracks in their societies.
That has to be because a few people are getting rich for doing it, I would imagine.
That's exactly what's happening. You're seeing the rise of right-wingers, and they're buying media, and they're buying opinion. I mean, basically, the Powell memo strategy that was employed in the United States is now being employed in Europe and around the world, by the way, in Japan as well. Pardon?
What's the Powell memo?
Lewis Powell in 1971 wrote a memo to his best friend, Eugene Sindor, who was the CEO of the president of the Chamber of Commerce, saying that we're under attack by liberals like Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson. And we've got to take the courts, we've got to take the schools, we've got to take the government, we've got to control public opinion with think tanks, we've got to consolidate the newspapers and magazines, and boom. And then Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, and they did it. Thanks, Dave, for the call. They did. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's interesting, the first draft of this New York Times article said 2 million fewer jobs. And there's a correction at the very end. An earlier version of a headline accompanying this article on the homepage was incorrect. The health law is projected to result in 2 million fewer workers, according to the Congressional Budget Office, not 2 million fewer jobs. So, you know, if Joe Manchin saw the 2 million fewer jobs headline and he said, oh, this is going to be the Waterloo, maybe he wasn't being a dummy. Because I don't think Joe Manchin's a dummy, but... I think this is just such a cool thing. This is great. 2 million people are going to get a break. Just imagine. I mean, can you imagine going to work every day at a job that you hate? I mean, having hot grease splattered all over you, going home with burns on your hands from running the fryer. I have done that. I can tell you, it is not fun. Washing dishes. I've done that. Washing dishes all day and going home with your skin cracking from the boiling water and the detergent. Can you imagine doing, you know, just work that you absolutely hate, but you're doing it for 40 or 50 hours a week because that's what it takes to get health insurance? And yeah, of course you need the income too, but you know, you could live with a little less money, but not without the health insurance. And now if you cut back to 30 hours a week, 25 hours a week, you can make enough money that you can live. You can be home by the time your kids come home. and you have health insurance because of Obamacare. This is like, this is a wonderful outcome. Why did the New York Times not frame it that way? Robin in Athens, Tennessee. Hey, Robin.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to tell you about something I don't think is being carried nationally yet. I heard this on the news while I was out and about today.
Mm-hmm.
The governor of Tennessee has proposed a program. If you're a citizen of Tennessee and you graduate high school, the state will pay for the first 2 years of community college or the first 2 years of trade school.
That is great. That's a great start.
It is. It makes sense to me. This is a Republican governor, okay? And I'm pretty sure he didn't take the Obama money.
Yeah.
For the insurance.
Tennessee has a Republican governor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I always mix up Tennessee and Kentucky. It was Kentucky was the state that took Obamacare, not Tennessee?
Tennessee. Yeah,
Tennessee.
I don't think we took it.
Okay.
But this is a great way to pull in jobs.
Yeah.
And it's a perfectly good conservative issue. It's states' rights, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why should we have to wait for the federal government to do it if we can do it?
No, you're absolutely right. Well, when I was living in Georgia, they started the Hope Scholarship thing down there, and a lot of kids started going to college as a result of that. And different states have done this with lotteries. I mean, Don Siegelman is rotting in jail right now, in large part because Karl Rove decided that he was a political enemy, but also because he supported having a lottery in Alabama and in order to pay for education. I mean, it's just go to free-don.org. It's a horror story. But hopefully that won't happen to your governor.
It kind of ties into that. They're going to pay for it with our state lottery.
Yeah, that is great.
You'll have the Hope Scholarship, but that scholarship, you have to earn that.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. You're right.
First 2 years of community college.
You're right. That's wonderful. Robin, thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for calling. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Cynthia in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Cynthia, you wanted to talk about Lafayette, Louisiana?
Yeah, you just cleared it up earlier. They were putting in, the utilities were putting in the cable when we left.
Okay, so Lafayette, Louisiana, also like Chattanooga, Tennessee, has a city run high speed broadband internet.
Yeah, that was the whole thing. They were putting it in. They had the cable was going in the ground for every home. They were running it like they do.
Yeah, Lafayette, Louisiana, and Bristol, Virginia. You're right. And in fact, this is in our daily take today. Lafayette, Louisiana, and Bristol, Virginia are the two other cities in addition to Chattanooga that have done this. Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you for that. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Sure. Well, real quick, the New York Times article, that should actually say Obamacare poised to lower the unemployment rate, right? I
mean, exactly.
If there's going to be more jobs opening up, it seems like that's going to reduce the unemployment rate. But I wanted to call because we were talking earlier about industry externalities, and something we're dealing with in South Chicago is the KCBX terminals and their dumping of petroleum coke, pet coke, along the Cal-Sag River, and just how dangerous and toxic that is, and just how industry externalities, I mean, not only need to be taxed, they need to be regulated. And
yeah, this is the poisonous solid waste that's left over after you refine coal tar, isn't it? I mean, coal.
Right, exactly.
Tar sands oil or whatever they call it. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's the waste from a refinery plant that's in the next state over.
Right. And it's so dirty to burn that it's illegal to burn it in the United States, so they ship it to China where they burn it.
Right. And they don't even keep this stuff indoors. Now, there's a proposal that is going to force this KCBX Terminals, which is owned by Charles Koch and Company. They're going to build a giant warehouse or a silo or stuff to keep this indoors. But right now they're just dumping it along the side of a river, and it's blowing into the air. It's making people that I know sick. Sometimes you can see clouds of this stuff, you know, when the winds pick up pretty badly. It's just something that needs to be dealt with, and why we need more regulations and why it's very important to protect the environment. because if you didn't, you would have this all over the place. And what can you do about it?
Yeah, this Pet Coke is becoming a really serious problem. I wonder if they'll change their names to the Koch brothers, you know, to try and disassociate themselves from. Who knows? But yes, you're right, Marty. And putting mountains of toxic stuff in the Windy City just doesn't seem like a good idea. Marty, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to CQ. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and information you're not going to hear on the corporate-owned media, together with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Complaining is not enough. Despair is not an option. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.